So please make yourself comfortable for this talk. I don't mind if you have an odd posture. So good evening. I'm Darlene Cohen of the Crystal Springs Sangha in Burlingame. I've been trained at the San Francisco Zen Center. So, as you all know, things are going badly. I'll tell you about it, right. And they've probably always gone badly, really. It's just that we may be more aware of it now, of people suffering around the world. I mean, this is a period of time. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when there were other really bad times, but now is one of those times when we're very aware of people suffering around the world and our own vulnerability. We're more aware of this than we were before September. And actually, at the time, I was surprised to hear in September from so many Zen students who were very upset that their feeling of basic security had been threatened, was shaken. And for me, I just wondered, why were they Zen students then? For me, I have always felt in peril. I mean, I've never had any basic security. So that aspect of the tragedy didn't bother me at all. I mean, it didn't touch me, that part. It was surprising to me to hear from Zen students that they had basic security that could be shaken up. Because for me, that was a big thing that drove me to practice. Many years ago, never being able to take refuge in anything, never having a solid place, security ever in any circumstance. That was a big thing for me. Now, I took a vow to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the three treasures, many years ago. I took this vow in the 70s when I became a lay Buddhist at the San Francisco Zen Center. That's part of it. I took the 16 Bodhisattva precepts. You probably know what those are, but those are the 10 grave precepts. This is the not killing and the not lying part. And then the three pure precepts, which are I vow to do no evil, I vow to live in enlightenment, I vow to live for the benefit of all beings. And then the last three are taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Now, at the time, I wondered, what the hell does that mean, taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? Now, I knew that the other precepts were not going to be easy, but at least they were comprehensible. I mean, I knew what not lying is. But taking refuge in the three treasures was a complete mystery. So I thought, well, I'll figure it out later. At that time, my basic strategy was to vow first and sort things out at leisure. So as it turned out, that sorting out process stretched out nearly 30 years. I mean, I did continue to notice during ceremonies at Zen Center where the three treasures were mentioned that I still had no idea what that was, but it didn't bother me. I mean, I was busy with other things. And so I tolerated not understanding what taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha was. In fact, my method, I mean, when I thought about it for this talk, my method for studying Buddhism in general I think, has been like a koan approach, which is that I tend to think about a phrase or a teaching. Something will catch my eye or kind of tickle my fancy, and then I bring it up to myself over and over again in different situations. Over years, maybe, I had a koan about anger for 7 years. That was what I thought about for 7 years. So I bring it up again and again in all situations until finally it unlocks itself for me. And I understand it in terms of my own life. And it may not be what the original teacher had in mind when they wrote, or the sutras or whatever, that I've been caught by. But I get it for me. I understand it for me. And it feels satisfying. And I'm personally guided by it, or challenged by it, or sometimes even comforted by it. And this is a kind of body way to understand the teachings. And I trust this. I trust this. I know I'm not the only one that has that approach. I think it's a trustworthy approach. So I guess I was a lot more curious about other teachings than I was about taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And I think that this is partly because as I said, I've never been able to imagine what that would be, to take refuge in something. So I think it just kind of stayed outside of my, it just wasn't accessible to me in some way. And so just kind of stayed outside for a long time. And I didn't really start to have some sense of what that particular teaching might mean or what it might refer to until this past year or so. And I realized during a period of great personal anguish and grief that taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is taking refuge in now, in the practice of mindfulness. And that this is really as good as it gets for human beings in this ephemeral world. And not only is it as good as it gets in terms of having some kind of strategy to deal with impermanence or flux, which we're constantly dealing with, but living your life this way fairly throbs with a vitality, with a reality that make your best fantasies of taking refuge in greed, hate, and delusion pale by comparison. For instance, making a lot of money and retiring to Hawaii with a really hot sex partner. Now that would be a good greed, hate, and delusion scenario, right? Now, I don't want to overstate the case for taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, but I do want to point out that isn't that greed, hate, and delusion where we usually go to take refuge? Isn't that what our habit is? In financial security? In a soulmate, in chocolate or cocaine, in our fantasies of ease and pleasure. My husband's like that. He has fantasies all the time about winning the lottery. He has this fantasy so consistently that over the years he's worked out exactly whether he's going to take it in a lump sum or a small payment, what the tax situation would be. He's worked out how he would keep this from his relatives. He has it worked out in all its details, and it really gives him great pleasure to sit there and fantasize what he would do, who he would donate to, what he would buy as his first purchase personally, that kind of thing. And I told him, this time, you know, the lottery has a high jackpot, so he was very interested again. And I said, you know, I think you have to buy a ticket first. So sometimes the fantasy is the whole thing. Or we now, I think our current cultural favorite refuge in the greed, hate, and delusion realm is busyness. If you're busy enough, you can keep yourself from being aware of your dissatisfactions and your fears, even that terrifying, gaping void that yawns up in front of you whenever you have an unstructured moment. But ironically, actually, I think that's a perfectly reasonable refuge, busyness. All you have to do is sink into your activity with total mindfulness. And there you are, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Pop! But people who use busyness as a refuge tell me that it's not very satisfying as a refuge, because they're always, instead of focusing on the activity they're doing, they're always focusing on the next activity. So they kind of miss the boat of their own busyness, actually. So what is it we all want, really? What's the bottom line for most of us? Well, I think we want to be safe and happy. I think we want to be whole, not fragmented. I think we want to be of use to other people. We want to be used up. We want to be used up, not always having something left over and craving something, some restlessness. So first, to obtain these things, I think first we try our strategies in the greed, hate, and delusion realm. We don't know anything else. And usually the first thing we try is to get as much pleasure as we possibly can. We have craving, so we try to satisfy it. Perfectly reasonable. And this is called greed. This is very simple strategy. It's perhaps the most primitive strategy for all organisms, not just humans. And this is what babies and small children are doing, is trying to satisfy all their cravings. And at some point, we get more sophisticated. For many people, it's in their teen years. For many people, it takes us a lot longer to figure it out. So as we get more sophisticated, we notice what the results of trying to satisfy craving are. And what a dead end that is as a strategy. Because with few exceptions, it just leads to more grief, and you know why. I mean, not only are you unable to get what you want in many cases, but sometimes you do get what you want, and then there's always the fear of losing it, or it's not just what you thought it was, or endless, right? You could tell me what the problems are with using the greed strategy to try to satisfy your yearnings, your cravings. And as you observe this dissatisfaction, you start to suspect that the problem is with craving itself, that might be the problem. So if you're observant and spiritually inclined, you might try the second most obvious strategy, which is to renounce craving and live a simple ascetic life, turning away from desire, denying yourself what you come to think of eventually as very frivolous, silly, unnecessary things. This is called hatred. You define yourself not by what you get, but by what you're turning away from. So these two strategies are the essence of delusion. You're either grasping or renouncing the things of the world according to your desires or your dislikes, your self-interest all the way. Both these strategies reinforce the sense of self, which is the ultimate delusion. because you're defining the rest of the world in terms of your needs at the time, or your likes or your dislikes. And the really terrible thing about these two strategies is that they take the life out of things. They steal their vitality. They make them dead. And that's because everything only stands in relation to you, your greed or your hatred. Nothing has its own shimmering uniqueness. You can't see that because you're too busy grabbing it or pushing it away. And of course, there's no satisfaction or security on either one of these paths because it's too much about me, both of them. So the reason I'm thinking a lot about this kind of thing these days, about taking refuge now, is because along with the rest of the world, I've had a really bad year. The worst since I got rheumatoid arthritis 25 years ago. That was a pretty bad year. And I think this has been the worst since then. It started off being full of crises for close friends. Really terrible crises. One friend lost her two dogs that she really loves. The first one was getting old, but it died a very painful death. And when she turned for solace to the much younger one, it died of cancer just a few months later. Very shocking, surprising. And then another friend's whole way of life changed when her partner of many years left her. Then another woman who's been a close friend of mine since we lived together many years ago at Green Gulch Farm abruptly broke off our relationship for reasons that have never really been clear to me. So I've been grieving that friendship all year, and my house is filled with tokens of love and affection that she's given me through the years. So I think of her every day. And, of course, my husband and I, like all of you, have had our share of sick and dying friends. Then a big event happened, which started in motion the long, wrenching process of breaking up our family. Our family consisted of my husband and me, and our son, Ethan, and his son, Anthony, 6 years old. So we were all evicted from our rent-controlled apartment in San Francisco. I'm not really evicted because that's illegal, but I won't go into the details. This has happened to 38,000 people in the past couple of years, according to the tenants' union. But actually, my husband and I are among the most fortunate of evictees. 4 years ago, when our landlord bought the building, it was clear to us that this would eventually happen, so we began looking for a place to live then. And we found the closest place we could afford was Guerneville, California, and we found a place there, like a little redwood cabin at Tassajara. If you've ever been at Tassajara, it looks a lot like one of those cabins. And so, fortunately, we, unlike many evictees, had a place to go. But the main problem then, was where would Ethan and Anthony go? The reason he was living with us in the first place is he's on a teacher's salary, a single parent with sky-high rent. So we tried to talk him into leaving the Bay Area, but he protested. He said, I can't leave my kids. And by that, he meant the gang kids that he works with in the mission. He's part of a program that tries to present young kids whose families are in gangs or who are heading in that direction. I'm talking about 12, 13, 14 years old. They try to present alternatives to break that cycle, and he's part of that project. And he said he wouldn't consider leaving his kids to go someplace else. So his immediate reaction to our eviction was despair and panic which became an orgy of sex and drugs for some time. And he was basically unreachable, inaccessible for about 6 weeks. And the baby, Anthony, went into abandonment mode. He got so anxious and crazed sometimes that he couldn't be comforted. If you've ever tried to coax an hysterical child out from under a piece of furniture, it's really awful, really awful thing to do. So fortunately, our son stabilized emotionally after about 6 weeks, but not before we all went through the mill. I felt my body tightening during that time, and for me, with rheumatoid arthritis, that has very unfortunate consequences. The joints swell as the pressure builds, and these are all the physical correlates of prolonged unhappiness for me. And I'd been free of active arthritis symptoms for several years, but then they came back then during this time to kind of underscore my plight. And then, as soon as my son stabilized and began to work on his end of the problem with a lot of energy and focus, then it was like I was free to begin to feel my own grief about leaving my home temple. We lived across from Zen Center and had for, on and off, for about 30 years. Now, I'm not a chronically depressed person. I'm much more of a delusion type. I mean, I'm so resilient and kind of ebullient, kind of hysterical, that I can barely hold on to even situational depression for a long period of time. But this was different. This was the long haul. And the symptoms of full-blown depression were very impressive to me. I mean, of course, I've had many friends, known many students, many people with chronic depression. I've never understood it. I mean, I don't now, but I lived for a while in these past months in some ways that I think are similar. I became really tired, beyond tired, weary, as my body continued to deteriorate physically. And following my usual schedule became really difficult. And whenever I could, between clients and classes and students and being with my grandson, whenever I could, I just collapsed and went to bed. So I was in bed, you know, for 15 minutes here, a half hour there, 40 minutes there, whenever I could, I went to bed. And no more walks in the park. I was too tired. Didn't get the swimming as often as I usually do. I've had a routine of swimming 3 and 4 times a week for years. I felt extremely heavy, dragging my reluctant body from place to place, kind of like an enforced walking meditation. And it took an extreme effort to do any tiny little thing, and I wasn't particularly interested in doing anything. That's the thing that my chronically depressed friends have talked about, not being interested in doing things, which has always been hard for me to understand. Now, when I was very first ill with arthritis about 25 years ago, I had very little energy and I lost a lot of weight. And I used to eat only what was easy, peanut butter on English muffins. That's what I ate for months when I was first ill. And I started eating at that level again because it was easy. I didn't have energy. So in depression, you feel isolated. You feel helpless and on your own, too fragile to interact. Everything breaks your heart wide open, and you don't want to be seen this way. At the very least, it's not cool, and it makes people uncomfortable. And at the worst, you're exposed for the needy, useless fool you really are, just a heartbeat away from babbling and drooling. And I wept at everything on TV. you know, in a Nike commercial, one person would put another person down. Oh my God. Or those telephone commercials where the extended family all get the new phones and talk to each other. Anyway, I was a mess in front of the TV. And that's where I wanted to be, actually, a lot. And I wept at older people on the street, noticing them, really, for the first time. People walking very slowly with burdens, plastic bags, heavier than they could quite manage comfortably. So I was completely batted about, you know, unable to grow a scab over my own wound and affected by the tragedies all around me. In fact, I was reminded of the sister of a friend of mine. She's chronically depressed, a very bright woman, and she's actually on disability because she's so depressed she cannot work. And she said to me once, she said, "Life is a raging sea, and I am kelp." I understood that. But fortunately, or unfortunately, my work itself demands intimacy. Real intimacy, can't be faked, with clients who are in pain, with students. So I'd go to a practice discussion, for instance, at Zen Center to see students. And the student would ask me how they could practice in whatever dire situation they were in. One student felt like she was actually inhabited, being feasted on by irritable demons all over her body. And another student described a situation in which she had unintentionally caused two of her best friends great misery because she had been focused on her self-interest in the situation. And in tears, she said, "I don't want to hurt people." So these were the kinds of things that people brought to me during this time. And bam, I'd be there in their suffering, in my suffering. It kind of all ran together. And I'd be willing to be in my suffering, quite focused, quite settled, not wanting to be anywhere else. Because it's so real. It's so compelling. And you can meet people there. Meet a lot of people in suffering. And every time I had practice discussion with students, I came away feeling refreshed and renewed, grounded. And I saw finally, after some time of this, that everybody, intentionally or not, was saving my sorry ass. So I settled into my suffering again and again because other people were in theirs. And I was so much more willing to stay there with someone else, two of us breathing, our bodies close. So thus it was that I took refuge in my moment-to-moment consciousness and in my interactions with other people. Depression gave me the chance to move back into my body, just like I had lived so fully when I first got arthritis. Doing my simple activity, the slow life that I had once lived for a long time, when I was much more affected by arthritis than I am now. Doing things simply to do them, not getting lost in the goal, in the goal orientation. And the reason I didn't get lost now, during this time, in the results of activity, was because I couldn't bear the possibility of more loss. If you get involved in the goal of your activity or the results, there's always the possibility of loss as opposed to when you're in the activity itself. So around this time, a good friend of mine, Michael Wenger at Zen Center, he told me of a koan that he particularly liked that he was intending to include in his new book of modern Zen koans. And here's the koan. A student asked Suzuki Roshi if a Zen teacher suffers the same way that his students do. Suzuki Roshi paused. Then he said, if he doesn't, he's not good enough. So I laughed when Michael told me this because I was reminded of the old classic fox koan. You know that one? Just briefly, it's the abbot of a prominent monastery is turned into a fox and made to spend 500 years as a fox, which is a very derogatory animal in Japan, or in Asia in general. Because when a student asked him if an enlightened person is free from cause and effect, he said yes. So he had to live for 500 years as a fox, a very bad thing. So I was reminded of that koan, and we started talking about that koan together. When I thought about the koan, I thought, now why did he say it that way? Not only emphatically, not just yes or no or whatever, but why did he say if he doesn't, he's not good enough? Why did he say it that way? That implied to me a choice. A choice. For instance, if you had the skill, say, you were an accomplished meditator, an arhat, or a yogi, you might choose not to suffer. And isn't that what we all start practice to do? To accomplish in the first place, to make the choice not to suffer. That's certainly what drew me to Zen practice, to acquire the training and the skills. I was intrigued by the possibility of being serene forever, to never have to worry about all this complication, to never be anxious or emotionally conflicted anymore. But now I'm not so sure. I do think that the skills you learn in practice can be applied this way. You can neutralize anything. You can run to your breath for peace of mind. You can let go of desire for a certain outcome. These are skills that you learn when you acquire the ability to go into samadhi. So this is maybe what an arhat is, a person who perfects equanimity, and then can leap into it from anywhere. But the trouble with doing that is it's pretty remote from the suffering that most of us do, that the world does, without having a choice. Dogen says in his guidelines for studying the way, this is guideline number 10, called immediately hitting the mark. He says, everyone has a body mind. In appearance and activity, its function is either leading or following, courageous or cowardly. To realize Buddha immediately with this body in mind is to hit the mark. Without changing your usual body in mind, just to follow Buddha's realization is called hitting the mark. Without changing your usual body and mind, he said. So I think when we're depressed or anxious, that's when we want to change our body and mind. We rush to change it. We prefer being calm, don't we? But I think Dogen's talking about hitting the mark with this usual body and mind means that the mark opens up to include everything, all states of mind, all depths of sorrow and confusion. you reside there in the midst of your ungroundedness, in the midst of your inability to focus, in the midst of your sorrow and pain, in the midst of being batted about by the vagaries of fate. That's where you are. So maybe it isn't really making the choice to suffer that Suzuki Roshi was talking about. Maybe he meant it's not changing the state of mind when you're suffering, but continuing to stay there no matter what it is, letting it be Buddha Dharma. During this time, if anyone had asked me directly what is practice, I would have said that the purpose of practice is to be able to stay in your suffering and not leap out into a preferred state of mind. Now, we're told, everybody is told, regardless of your tradition, I think, we're told from day one to sit in our suffering, right? Isn't that what we're told? And that's the practice of being constant, of being courageous, just sitting there no matter what hits you. But I suspect that this may not look like what you think it looks like. I think that it may look more like you sit in your suffering and then you flinch away. You can't stand it. It's unbearable. So you go away, but you come back and you sit there until it's unbearable and you flinch away again. You go to the movies. Then you come back and you sit in your suffering. And then you flinch away again. You go into denial. The diagnosis was wrong. You go away and then you come back again. And the practice is in the commitment to come back again and again and again until it's so unbearable you have to leave again. And then you come back. So then one day in my misery, I noticed that my pit wasn't bottomless. Even when I seemed to be in free fall, I would eventually discern some kind of gentle net. Because despite the pain and the uncertainty, there was always the immediacy of the present, even when the present was wretched. That immediacy is very vital. So then it occurred to me that what that might be is the three treasures. That maybe in my willingness to feel what was actually happening to me, maybe that's what that was, taking refuge in the three treasures, in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Because in taking refuge, we have to give up our habits of comfort and reassurance. The tape that starts running, or at least for me, it's a tape that starts running. The reassurance, oh, I read that wrong. That didn't really happen. Fluffing myself up. Since we aren't going to be able to choose our state of mind, and we can't afford to prefer any of them, because if they don't work out, then we're devastated. This particular time in our history might be a particularly good time to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, because when you take refuge in the three treasures, you give up the idea of basic security. You give up your attachment to it, your sense of it'll be all right because I'm very smart, I have an IRA, I have a spouse who doesn't dare leave me, are all the other things that you say in your comforting tape whenever things go wrong. So you have to give up these habitual reassuring thought patterns. And this is hard to do when they're working. But when something really terrible happens and they don't work anymore anyway. But when you can acknowledge that you're lost and confused. You're more open to taking refuge than when things are going well. When you can still fluff yourself up and say, well, the stock market will come back. Because it's hard to imagine then, when you can be fluffed up, it's hard to imagine then that you could fall so far and that there's nothing to break your fall. There's nothing to grasp that's solid as you're falling by. So by taking refuge in the Buddha, just to explain what Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is for me, I mean that I understand that I have a role model for working with my own mind as the source of chaos and sorrow. He was someone who, like me, had to deal with family problems, with his daily living situation, the outrage at injustice, helplessness, all those things, the seduction of pleasure and ease when you have it. And I think it's so important to have Buddha and the thousands of teachers through the ages that we've had is that we can be inspired by the fact that none of them had any more to work with than we do. I mean, they lived in times where there were spiritual trips, just like now in the Bay Area. We can choose spiritual trips. And when they ran through all those trips, they finally settled on their own minds as the object of focus and effort. And they finally woke up and rejected spiritual materialism as a refuge and experienced their lives directly. And by taking refuge in the Dharma, I mean that you find a path for yourself, like Buddha did. He taught the Eightfold Path, which are guidelines for developing our awareness on our own path. And if you diligently cultivate the ability to relate to your experience, all of it, without judging whether this is good or bad, all of your experience, fully and intimately, then you evolve an attitude of curiosity and interest toward all your experience. And this makes everything a source of learning and discovery. So you're less likely to divide the world up into holy and ordinary, good, bad, pure, and profane, things like that. So instead of living a life solely based on grasping and averting from things, we can cut through to our own experience of our sense impressions of other people, of situations, and we can decide where we end and other people begin for ourselves. So nothing then is a waste of time. All of life is a fertile situation. And this means we can face life directly without hope and mottos, without the padding of hope and mottos. We can face it cold and clear. Now, Zazen is where you get, or meditation, breath meditation, is where you get the stability to do this. You watch things rise and pass away again, just like in your regular off-the-cushion life. Your ultimate consolation is the richness and shimmering uniqueness of everything. And by taking refuge in the Sangha, I mean that you make friends of your fellow refugees who are lost and confused like you are. They're your role models, good and bad role models. And they provide feedback and support. They're committed by their practice to being real with you, not just being polite. So they're where you go for some reality check, where your arrogance or your delusion can be challenged. And this kind of commitment to being genuine and helpful doesn't grow on trees. The Sangha is a rare and precious gem. These are the people, these people around you. And if you come from small groups or other Sanghas, these people are the ones who took a vow to be your best friend. So I wish you your own solace from the three treasures. Thank you very much. We have a few minutes for questions. Are there any questions? You're all stunned. Yes.
So we in a time of challenge, I find myself doing what I can do to focus on the present moment and the whatever gifts there are there. But certainly that takes me away from the huge uncomfortableness and the fear of the future and all the rest of it.
It does?
It does.
The present moment takes you away from fear and hopelessness?
Yeah.
What if in the present you're fearful and hopeless?
I realize that right now I'm fine.
Oh, you mean in terms of right now you are alive?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So, I guess I don't quite understand what you're saying. At the one level, I hear you telling us to stay in the present and then at the same time not to go away from our suffering. It seems like when I the more I come into the present, I sometimes question, am I in denial of this whole catastrophe around me? Or, you know, so I guess I don't quite understand what you're saying.
Well, in any present moment, right, like this one, for instance, there are thousands of things you could focus on, right? Sound of my voice, light, color, the people around you, your rear end on the many, many things. The sound outside, everything. In any present moment, you have all this that you could focus on. And some of it is intrusive, actually. For instance, right now, my voice might be intrusive because it's loud and it might drown out some other things. So I find in the present moment, if something is intrusive, like, let's say, great physical pain, then it will drown out the other focus. And what I have to do is just get more panoramic to include more things in that, but there's no denying that there's physical pain, or maybe my heart is beating fast from anxiety, but that's part of what's in the moment. And I agree with you that actually the more you can allow into that present moment, the more neutralized the anxiety or the pain would be. In fact, when I counsel people in pain, what I try to help them do is refine their consciousness enough so that they have a great deal of things to choose from in any present moment. If you're only aware of 10 things in a moment and one of them is pain, that's more pain than you can bear. But if you're aware of 100 things in the present moment, that's probably pain you can live with. So, do you understand where I'm going here? So it's focus. So you have all these possibilities in any present moment of what you're going to focus on. And what I'm suggesting tonight is that if you have a very intrusive focus, like anxiety, say, anxious thoughts, oh, something terrible is going to happen, something terrible is happening, blah, 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 as I was talking about, I'm suggesting that you allow that to be Buddha Dharma. And that can be one of the things that you leave alone and allow to be in that moment with you, along with the fact that you're perfectly okay. Because as just as you said, in any present moment where you can think, well, here's the present moment, you probably are okay. You're fed, you're warm, you're comfortable, blah, blah. So I'm just suggesting for people who like to leap out of any of those things that are unpleasant in any present moment, I'm suggesting that they let it be, to not worry about it, because also, as you're implying, the next present moment is going to be different anyway. Does that help? Thank you for your question. That was good. Yes. You're welcome.
I have a question, and this is probably a beginner's question, so excuse me if it is, but I was very interested in what you said about craving and hatred, and how at the beginning you crave and then you can renounce, and that's hatred. I'm curious to know how it fits in with an addiction, like alcoholism or drug addiction. And it seems to me that if a person has a real problem with a substance, they need to renounce it and choose a kind of aestheticism around that substance.
I totally agree.
So you allow the space for the hatred?
I think it probably works best if the person doesn't hate what they renounce. Because then there's still passion and attachment, and that's very dangerous. For instance, a child of an alcoholic, for instance, I'm thinking of a friend of mine, even though she herself was never an alcoholic, both her parents were alcoholics, and for many years she never touched alcohol, never had wine with dinner. It was the cause of all my suffering as a child. Oh, it's the cause of great pain in the world. Never touched it. And, you know, I wasn't going to be the one to break it to her, you know, that she was as attached as her parents were. But gradually she came to understand this, that was an extreme position. And she took her time. And now she has wine with dinner. She's in no danger of being alcoholic, and I think a lot less danger than when she, every time she saw, you know, any alcohol, the demon.
What about the actual?
What do you mean?
The actual,
well, the person who really has been completely defeated by the judgment and can't have a choice of having a glass of wine. Well, I think they probably shouldn't. I'm kind of missing your point. You're saying that I suggested that this was, you know, a delusional place to come to be in a strategy of hatred in which you put something over there. But I'm just saying that you can very much put something over there and not hate it. You can say this is a bad... I mean, I personally try not to eat meat. And I don't, it's not that I hate beefsteaks and stuff like that. I just prefer this way. And if someone offers me, if I'm at someone's house and they're serving meat, I will eat it. Because I think it's more important to be polite and kind. So in a value system like that, like you're suggesting, this person should put the alcohol away and go on with their life. Do you understand? I think I have to stop. I'm sorry.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.